This is Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are a Quantum Leap podcast, but we recently finished our rewatch of the TV series. We're going to go back later and cover the novels and comics, but for now, we're talking about other TV shows and movies we love. This week, we're talking about WandaVision, the hit Marvel TV series on Disney, The Queen's Gambit on Netflix, and the series premiere of CW's Superman and Lois. You can find us on all the familiar social media sites by searching Fate's Wide Wheel, and we would love it if you subscribed and reviewed us on Apple Podcast. It really makes a difference. And now, we hope you enjoy this week's episode.
A tidbit that I found fascinating is that the original script for the wedding episode, they were going to have a horse go over Niagara Falls.
Oh my God.
And it was an all night that the showrunner creator Greg Daniels, and Minnie Kaling, they were all about it, and everybody else had to talk him out of it. And finally, it took Steve Carell, who had some say as a producer, to say please don't do this.
Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't say jumping the shark anymore.
Yeah.
We'd say something like, you know, the horse went into Niagara.
Yes, it would. But I'll leave you to read the book and like, yeah, what that story was going to be and how they were going to send a horse over Niagara Falls.
Man, I'm looking forward to reading it. I've heard good things about it. I've almost bought it on my own a couple of times, actually. And I know with Jess listening to the Office Ladies podcast, I'm sure she'll be excited to kind of read more stuff as well.
Yeah.
It's funny. I hear some of the Office Ladies sort of secondhand because every once in a while, like if Jess is cleaning or, you know, sometimes when she's, you know, kind of doing her nighttime routine or whatever, she'll put it on but not have her AirPods in.
Sure.
So I'll kind of be listening a little bit too. And it's so odd to me because here are two people that clearly know each other very well, have known one another for, you know, nearly 20 years, and yet their conversations just often sound very overproduced.
Yeah.
Like they're not comfortable just talking to one another.
I don't know. Go read the reviews on Apple sometime.
Okay.
And I think that may inform it.
Okay.
Because it seems like they've gotten a lot of negative reviews because they are too personal. They're too chatty. They go on too many, they go on too many side tangents.
Hmm. Well, how in the world would a podcast survive?
I know. I don't wonder because of like, yeah, I mean, they're obviously they're part of a larger network. It's just, yeah, that's right. Just kind of comes
it's
with
the,
it.
I mean, it's the rage these days, and it's not just because of the pandemic. I mean, a lot of these podcasts were planned far before the pandemic started, but, you know, there are so many podcasts out there now that have, you know, actors from shows that were popular in the aughts. And they're, you know, I can think of three right off the top of my head. You've got the Office Ladies, you've got Two Fake Doctors, and you've got Talking Sopranos. And like all three of those, you know, the shows were, again, from the early aughts. You've got two actors from the show. In the case of Two Fake Doctors, I mean, you've got like two of the leads. You've got Zach Braff and, Donald Faison.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and there are more, you know, those are just a few. It is interesting to me because I feel like it's one of those things where your mileage may vary. I've listened to a few of the Sopranos ones as well. I haven't listened to much of Two Fake Doctors, which I feel is a shame because based off of what I've heard and what Jess says, that one would probably be my favorite out of the bunch. Mm-hmm. Just because those two guys have such great chemistry anyway.
Sure,
and their conversations, they'll allow themselves to go on tangents, but apparently the tangents are always a lot of fun and very interesting, especially when they have guests on. Mm-hmm. So it ends up being just as much their forum for talking about stuff as it is about Scrubs.
Sure.
You know?
And I think
did you watch Scrubs?
Oh, yeah. Love Scrubs. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've probably seen earlier season episodes more frequently than the last few seasons, but
same here.
Yeah. And I even tried giving the spinoff after version, and that was, that one I found myself just wanting it to be canceled. What's the guy who played Cox, the actor who played him? I was like, man, just cancel this so he can get on and do better work now. And I haven't seen him do a whole lot since
then. Neither have I. Yeah. Where are you, McGinley?
I don't know. But I also know, too, that he has a child with Down syndrome. So I have a feeling that he stuck around for the after show basically for a paycheck.
Sure.
And maybe since then he's kind of retired. I don't know.
Right, right. Yeah, it's interesting. I have a friend of mine, and she will defend that version of Scrubs to her dying breath. And I'm just like, no, it's bad. It's just not good.
It's, yeah.
Which is, you know, whatever. It's one of those shows that I genuinely feel like the first few seasons were so good and so fresh, and you had people who were so interested in the work and so connected and attached to the work. And then, quite frankly, you know, you have what has happened with a few other shows here and there. You had Zach Braff in particular go off and get to do other things, bigger and better things. And you know, he all of a sudden was not just a TV star, but now he's, you know, kind of a burgeoning movie star, which I don't think he ever fully capitalized on, quite frankly.
And sure.
Maybe part of that is because he did keep going back to Scrubs. Who knows? But the show was able to attract, you know, high profile guest stars. And I think a lot of that just had to do with the quality of the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm of the mind that once the show left NBC in particular.
Oh, I forgot that. Really, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it one season? It two really seasons? Kind of
Yeah, it was two seasons on ABC.
Ah, okay. Yeah, forgot that.
Yeah. But, yeah. God, it was, yeah. For a while there, that was definitely one of my favorite shows. I say this with no shame whatsoever, but a friend of mine and I once watched the entire first season in one day.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
I went over to his house. We were just hanging out. We threw in the first disc. Before we knew it, we threw in the second disc. Before we knew it, we threw in the third disc, and I realized I'd been there for like 12 hours.
Yeah, and then he's like, well, now we got it. We got to finish it now. We can't.
Right, right. It's like, we're finishing it. We're finishing it.
We can't.
Speaking of finishing it.
Yeah.
I today was able to finish the latest episode of WandaVision.
I watched it twice yesterday, once by myself, once with Betsy.
All right. I didn't know if I was going to catch up, honestly.
Yeah. And just one episode left. So here's how I thought we would do WandaVision today. Like, do a few minutes, relatively spoiler-free.
Sure.
Minor spoilers. Basically, to, like, if listeners haven't seen the show yet, kind of on the fence of watching the show, or they only watched the first couple of episodes and kind of petered out. Because I know a lot of people who watch the first two episodes and are like, I can't. I don't know what this is. I'm done. Sure. So, because I feel like there's a lot to talk thematically about the show. You can kind of talk about the show kind of somewhat spoiler-free. And then we can warn people like, hey, if you haven't seen, if you're not caught up yet and you don't want spoilers, we'll put a thing in the notes like, hey, jump ahead to this timestamp in the podcast.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
And then you can talk about Queen's Gambit and Superman and Lois however you want. I've hit the age. I'm almost 42. I don't care about spoilers for the most part. Life is short. I really kind of hit the attitude of Billy Crystal in When Harry Met Sally, of how when I'm reading a novel, I always skip ahead to the last page to find what happens because I might die before then. That's very much where I'm at now.
I have to admit, ever since I saw that film, which I'd seen bits and pieces of it, but the first time I ever watched the whole thing all the way through, I want to say I was about 20. And in the back of my head, I've always had that, like, that thought, like, huh, at what point will I start, like, doing that? Will I ever do that? I've been tempted a couple of times to do that, especially if I'm reading a book I'm not 100% on board with.
Yeah.
I'm sort of like, maybe I should just skip to the end.
Yeah. I say that. I haven't done that with books. TV shows, whatever. I'm just like, wait, whatever. Just whatever. Just skip ahead. Give me the spoilers. What's going to happen? Especially ongoing TV shows. Because I'm like, ever since Lost, I'm just like, are you going to burn me?
Yeah.
Is it going to be 6-7 years and then you just totally shit the bed with the finale?
I can imagine it. Someday we'll talk about Lost.
we'll get there. It's... Yeah. Yeah. The thing I appreciate about WandaVision is that it's 9 episodes and that's it. Now, I've heard some stuff out there, like there is some telltale evidence that there are actually 10 episodes. And that they may drop that on us.
At the last, I mean, that I'd be fine with that. It's funny because as the last episode, and again, no spoilers, as the last episode wrapped up, I did have a feeling of it feels like there's got to be more. Either that or the last episode is going to be double-sized, which I know that they did, like, with The Mandalorian. So I wouldn't be surprised if maybe episode 9 is twice, you know, is the double the normal length. Which, again, kind of, you know, staying away from spoilers, one of the things that I would certainly tell people if they're on the fence and haven't gotten into the show yet, or if maybe they watched the first episode and were like, meh. I mean, you can't hate a show that packs as much in emotionally, thematically, and plot-wise in a short amount of time. I mean, the episodes are only like half an hour long. So it's a pretty easy watch, and I would say that, you know, if you can kind of just, it's hard for me to say this because I can't imagine not enjoying those first two episodes, but if you can get through to the third episode, and especially the fourth episode, like, you're going to be sailing by that point. So,
yeah, and I will say,
that's one thing I would definitely say.
Yeah, I will say, like, for me, like, when I first heard about the show, I was only kind of, like, vaguely, it's like Wanda and Vision and like a different series, and it didn't really land on my radar because I've never been a huge fan of the Marvel TV shows. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. tried to get into, couldn't really. Jessica Jones, loved the first season, then kind of petered off. Wanted to love Daredevil and didn't. So WandaVision I was just kind of meh on. And then I heard about the sitcom angle. And on top of that, like how seriously they took it. How the actors basically went to sitcom boot camp to learn the nuances of the acting styles between decades. And that's like, all right, now I'm interested. Yeah. Like, I'm all of a bit, you know, because I think it's fair to say, like, none of the movies have really given Wanda and Vision very much focus or like, a fair amount of focus at all. I was not emotionally invested in those characters.
Yeah, I would say it is interesting because, you know, until in Age of Ultron, you know, they're, you know, Wanda's there. In Civil War, you know, again, they're kind of just there. It's not until you get to Infinity War, and by that time, so much of the relationship building between the two of them has happened off screen, really. That it's a testament to Paul Bettany and Elizabeth Olsen that in Infinity War they were able to have the relationship that they do have, and that the moments in particular towards the end of that film land so strongly. Because, yeah, they didn't get the same amount of screen time that others did for that relationship building.
Because if I recall correctly, like,
a relationship like between the Hulk and Black Widow, which gets swept under the rug by the last, you know, couple of movies, got more screen time than their relationship did.
Yeah, because if I recall correctly, like, there's the kind of a hint of them bonding in Age of Ultron, and then by the time we get to Infinity War, like, they're just a couple.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the first time we see them, like, they're in bed together at night and they get this sudden attack. It's been a couple years since I've seen Infinity War, but that's pretty much it, right?
Yeah.
All right, because I thought maybe I'd missed something. I was like, oh, they're a couple now. All right, he's a robot. All right, this is weird. All right, sure, whatever.
It's interesting with the MCU how much of the, you know, they embrace the fact that a large portion of the fan base has knowledge of these characters outside of the films. And so there are certain things that I think that they'll allow themselves to sort of get away with. And they do it wonderfully because they rely on the actors. They rely on, you know, little bits of script here and there that allow them to do, you know, a 45-minute fight scene, you know, kind of eschewing some of that other character development that they're not going to show us on screen because, you know, there are certain things that I guess some fans will take as a given and other fans will hopefully pick up on and appreciate, you know, due to the performances, you know, and that ultimately there's this sort of trust with the audience that says, look, we don't have time to show you all this, but just know that this is the way things are, that these two characters are in bed together. you know, literally and figuratively. And so I do think that it works so well because the world building in general through the course of the films has been so strong. You know, I think compared to other film universes, there are others that don't necessarily do that as well. I think you could certainly, as much as I hate to, you know, build something up at the expense of something else, I will say that with the new Star Wars films, one thing that you could certainly say is that that's not something that those three movies did very well. They were kind of all over the place as opposed to, you know, really doing some of that world building that would have allowed certain relationships and certain moments to land in a way that felt natural.
I mean, I feel like with Star Wars, what their problem was with this last trilogy is they didn't have the story written out. Or if they did, right, like they changed it to adjust to fan backlash. You know, they totally set Finn up. Finn, is that the right character? Yeah. They totally set Finn up to be a hero and to possibly be a Jedi. And he's basically just almost swept aside in the last movie.
Yeah.
And you know, we can, you know, go all day about like the politics behind that. And the thing is, like, I'm just a casual fan of the Star Wars movies. Like, I'll show up, I'll go for the spectacle, you know, whatever.
Sure.
You know, it just kind of rolls off me, but I can understand why people get very upset about it.
Yeah. It, you know, the thing is that because so much of our conversation about these things is dominated, you know, by social media and in the realm of social media, it is difficult to not see. For instance, it was announced yesterday, I believe, that J.J. Abrams will be producing the next Superman movie and that Ta-Nehisi Coates will be writing it. And so already, you know, in less than 24 hours, I have been on Reddit and the immediate backlash from people who haven't read one word of script, who haven't seen 1 minute of film, who haven't heard one casting decision, is just, I mean, it's disgusting, really. It's one of those things where it's like everyone, you know, everyone has a right to their opinion, yes, but now everyone thinks their opinion matters. And sometimes your opinion doesn't matter at all. And so it's one of those things where, you know, and I say this as a guy who has a podcast talking about entertainment, but, you know, the thing is that...
But you're humble about
it. When these people get out there and they start criticizing these things, and then they don't understand when someone says, hey, man, that might be a little racist, you know, which is a kind way of saying you're racist. They don't understand that. And it's just sort of like, all I've heard you do is bitch about the fact that you don't want a black Superman. Tell me what I'm supposed to think. Like, you know, it's just, it kind of is mind boggling to me. The fact that they'll throw all this crap out there and they'll bitch about all these things. And then when somebody calls them out on it, then of course it's like, no, not me, not me. And it's like, okay, dude, whatever. First of all, they haven't even cast an actor to play Superman yet. Second of all, if they do cast a person of color to play Superman, what does it matter? You haven't read the script. You don't know what it's going to look like. You know, it's one of those things that I don't understand. It's the same with the backlash to Rey, to Rose, you know, to female characters, to, you know, anything that doesn't fit their particular vision is not only fair game for criticism, but now it's fair game for a level of criticism which resembles some sort of like scorched earth policy that drives people off their Instagram, that causes them to have anxiety, so much anxiety that they beg the writers of the next film to make sure they don't have a big part, which Kelly Marie Tran apparently, allegedly, told the writers, I don't want a big part in Rise of Skywalker, because she had been so affected by the bullying, the cyberbullying that she got during The Last Jedi.
I didn't know that.
Which is why Rose has such a small part in the movie.
And I loved her. She had like the more central part.
It's in like, what gives you the right?
Because she had the more central part in the second movie. What was the name of the second movie?
Yeah. The Last Jedi.
The Last Jedi. That was the second movie?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, The Last Jedi.
That was the second one, yeah.
Yeah, I loved her. And I was aware of the cyberbullying. I didn't realize that she had asked for a smaller part to be written for. That, yeah. And that's what...
Which I think, as a result, affected Finn's overall storyline as well.
Yeah. And here's the thing. When, you know, I joked when Harrison was born, like, these conversations of, like, in what order do I introduce him to the Star Wars movies, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's for social media laughs. I think more I'm looking forward to introducing him to the Marvel's movies. That'll be more interesting.
Yes.
Because I feel like their storytelling, it's more true to some sort of vision than it is to relenting to the worst of the fanboys.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, what Marvel has done and what, like, you know, Paul Feige and the crew that have worked on these films and the television series have done, is pretty remarkable, because it's not easy, clearly. You know, you look at what Warner Brothers has tried to do with DC Expanded Universe, and, you know, you look at what Disney has tried to do with Star Wars, and it's been difficult. And you know, where Disney has succeeded is by, you know, trusting the creators having a vision, you know, like Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni with The Mandalorian, and really seeing that through. And I think it's been a learning process for all involved. You know, but I think that when you look at, like, shared universes, that the MCU is definitely the symbol, you know, the roadmap that says, hey, if you're going to do this, take the time, the care, work with the right people, and follow through. You know, don't worry about what happens when you make your first Captain America movie or your first Thor movie and the response is a little tepid. Because you're going to get there, and you're going to have your moments where maybe things are kind of like, yeah, this is good, you know, or your third Iron Man movie or whatever. But by the time you get to Endgame, it doesn't matter, you know.
You're going to have your Incredible Hulks, which I like, but still. I mean, I just really, like, articulated this in my head as you were talking. The DC movies aren't so bad. They would not be so bad if the MCU didn't exist. But the MCU does it so damn well. They make DC look bad.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and it's not like the MCU hasn't sort of taken opportunities to say, yeah, you know, we made this, and there are certain things that are integrated, but overall, we're going to ignore it. Like, with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is kind of no longer on the roadmap now. You know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was a show that they produced at the time saying, like, yeah, it's going to fit in, it's going to work. And now it's kind of just its own thing.
Was
it
decanonized, basically?
Kind of, yeah. The all of the Netflix Marvel shows, which again were supposed to kind of fit. There's references, especially in the first season of Daredevil, there's all sorts of references to the Avengers movie and, you know, to other things. Now those shows are, you know, they don't really exist in the canon anymore. For what it's worth, I thought the first two seasons of Daredevil were superb. I thought the first season of Jessica Jones might be even better than that. I thought the first season of The Punisher was fantastic. Yeah, unfortunately, the second season of Jessica Jones was hot garbage.
You know, here's the thing. I started watching the second season only because I loved the first season so much, but I knew it was going to be a letdown, because after you have David Tennant as your big bad, where do you go from there?
Right.
Especially with a character who has the powers that Kilgrave has.
Right.
Like, well, where do you go from there?
They spent so much time in that first season, you know, having, you know, Jessica face a lot of her demons and seemingly, you know, start to overcome and deal with a lot of those things, that to basically set the character back in the second season for basically drama's sake felt like kind of a betrayal of all the character growth and work that had been done in the first season. I'm not saying I wanted, like, a perfectly healed, you know, Jessica Jones running around in the second season. She still had demons to battle, but it felt like it felt like there was a mission in the second season that after a couple of episodes that we're going to put her back to square one.
Sure.
You know, as opposed to this is someone who's really, really, like, grown a lot over the course of all of this. So,
yeah.
And I was like, neither here nor there.
Yeah. Here at the Freimeyer household, we love Jessica Jones so much. We named our dog Jessica Jones. So, but yeah, but I don't think that's going to happen to WandaVision to bring it back around. I don't think it's going to get decanonized as it goes along.
No. In fact, I would say that, you know, the care and attention that they have taken with WandaVision, right down to the filmmaking itself, is, you know, it is absolutely what Paul Feige kind of promised, is that he intended for these shows to be on par with the films. That these shows were not just going to be like a watered down version, which, if we're just shooting straight, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was a watered down version of everything that made the MCU great. You know, you had one actor that you could kind of bring in to kind of ground the show with Clark Gregg, who's great. He's great. You know, you had a couple of guest spots from Sam Jackson and, you know, Sif from the Thor movies and Maria Hill, Kobe Smulders, you know, you had that. But other than that, you know, there wasn't anything else. And by the time they got to like their third or fourth season, that show no longer seemed to resemble or have anything whatsoever to do with the MCU. And that's fine. But it never rose to the heights that of the movies. Whereas WandaVision, in my estimation, in the first four episodes alone, again, down to the cinematography, the script, the performances, equaled some of the highs of the films.
Oh, yeah. I would agree with that. And I know it's worth noting, I think the average budget per episode is like $25 million.
So crazy.
Because sometimes, like, even like the most recent episode, like its opening scene was a very special effects laden scene, and I found myself rewatching it with Betsy last night, just kind of like looking for the cracks that you see in TV special effects.
Right.
And I could find none.
Yeah. Yeah. Should we just switch to spoiler talk?
No, I mean, I guess what I wanted to say about like WandaVision, like non-spoiler free, like for the first couple episodes, is the thing that I appreciate about the show is that it seems like the Venn diagram between people who appreciate old sitcoms like Dick Van Dyke mm-hmm. and Bewitched and comic book nerds seems to be a relatively small overcross lap. So I'm like, this ticks up because like I grew up watching Dick Van Dyke and Bewitched and Old Nick at Night. So like the first two episodes, like everything like from the MCU aside, like you could take the first two episodes just based on like what the premise of the show within the show is of witch and half robot trying to hide their identities in suburbia. And those episodes work.
Yeah.
Like I could see that existing as a sitcom.
Absolutely. That's the thing that I think I enjoyed so much, especially I think the second episode specifically really hit on.
I love the magic show in the second episode. The magic show.
Yeah, yes. I thought the first episode was great, don't get me wrong, but the second episode specifically, I'm like you. If that was an actual show, I would watch just that. I would watch that show. Like, it wouldn't have to have the MCU hook. Like, I would think that was funny and intelligent and well-acted. Like, I would just want to watch that show. And that, to me, is definitely a sign of the success of the creators, like really kind of coming together and being able to use these tropes from sitcom past and apply them to this story. And like you said, it's like the ingredients were already there, you know, a witch and her android husband hiding out in suburbia. But you do it as a, you know, 25 minute sitcom. It's like, yeah, if you pitched that to somebody at any point in television history, somebody probably would have been like, yeah, let's make that a show. I mean, they basically already have, really, in a lot of ways.
Last weekend, I went back and I watched like the first two episodes of Bewitched because they're free on IMDb TV. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, wow, yeah, this is basically like WandaVision in half. Instead of two super, right. You know, instead of two super beings, whatever, you just have the one. And like, yeah, this is it. But I loved it. But I have a lot of friends, like they could not get through those first two episodes because they don't have the appreciation for old sitcoms. And maybe this can be our segue into spoiler territory. What I told them to do was like, start watching at episode four. Watch episode four. See how this really fits into the real, quote, the real world. and then jump back and then watch those episodes, because then you can kind of appreciate what is going on.
Yeah, and I think that you're right. I think that, that is a route that some people could take if they want to. For me personally, that level of you know, almost hand-holding, basically, would have diminished the show, in my opinion. By watching the first three episodes as they are and then seeing that fourth episode, it was so much fun to, you know, kind of fill in the blank at certain times and see how the pieces really start to fit together. Jess asked me right off the bat, you know, she's like, what do you think this is going to be about, before we started watching it? And I told her, I think it's going to be about one woman grieving and how she comes to term with that grief. And it just so happens that she has incredible powers and can do whatever she wants. So maybe she doesn't deal with that grief in the most positive of manners, but rather than, you know, do a lot of drugs or, you know, drink or, you know, whatever, she gets to create this world, you know, that she can live in. And part of that was because I was aware of, you know, comic book storylines like House of M, which this series draws a bit on, which basically was a... that storyline in Marvel accomplished a couple of things. It allowed them to diminish the role of mutants in the comic books, because at that particular time, the MCU was just getting started. But unfortunately, they did not own the rights to the mutants. They'd sold those off to Fox. So the idea was, let's put more focus on the non-mutant characters that are going to be featured in these movies that we're really going to be pushing, and let's find a way to do that. Because at that particular point in Marvel Comics history, mutants were everywhere. You know, the mutants were like your flagship characters. And so the idea was that Wanda, Scarlet Witch, has created this world in her mind, in her own vision, because of trauma that she suffered due to similar events like happened in the comics. I don't want to say too much because I don't know what's going to happen in the future of the show. But so I knew that would probably be a bit of it. The thing that fascinated me from the get-go is that there are hints, even in that first episode, you know, upon close viewing, there are hints right off the bat that, you know, that things are amiss, beyond just the idea that this is Wanda and Vision in a 1950s sitcom. There are little things that happen. I just feel like it's a rewarding show. So there's a part of me that doesn't understand why people would stop if they are at all interested or invested in the MCU, much less if they like old time sitcoms.
I don't know. I mean, I very much had the same thought, but again, I love old sitcoms, so I could appreciate all of that. But yeah, and what I also loved about those first two episodes is that this may seem like a little bit of a stretch, but it almost kind of reminded me of Life on Mars, where you have a character that is in this weird reality that you don't quite know what it is, and they keep dropping hints that something is amiss. I especially felt that similarity in the second episode when the voice comes through the radio and says, Wanda, who's doing this to you, Wanda? That is something very similar to the things that they did with Life on Mars. Life on Mars, if you don't know, was originally a UK series. It was a short-lived US series about a present-day cop who gets in an accident, and he wakes up and he is a cop working the same precinct in the 1970s. And there's like the saying of like, is he really in the 1970s? Is he crazy? Is he in a coma after his accident? You don't know. And I felt, maybe not plot wise, but very like thematically, and some of like the little tricks that he did in the first couple episodes, I felt kind of a little bit of similarities between those two.
Yeah.
I loved all the like the creepy little bits like they put in the first couple episodes. Like in the first 5 minutes, like, you know, something is amiss because both Wanda and Vision, they can't seem to remember what their life was like before they moved to Westview. Like, even, like, what their life was like before that right. particular day.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things, too, that I think, again, the show is not made. It can be enjoyed, yes. But let's face it, this show is not made for people who aren't already familiar with these characters. And I say that, you know, mostly because even from that first episode, there is a sense of sadness and loss that pervades certain moments. And even the, you know, yes, it fits the trope, obviously, of a 1950s sitcom. And you know, visually it's striking, but the idea that this world is drained of color is also so perfect. I mean, when Vision dies in Infinity War, his body drains mm-hmm. of all the color as the stone is ripped out. Like, there's so much more at play here that goes far beyond just saying, like, hey, we're going to have fun with these sitcoms. The way that memory is used, the fact that, yeah, they don't remember. Now, of course, Wanda does. She's just kind of fooled herself, and I think starts to, you know, those layers get ripped away quicker for her than anyone else. But the idea that Vision can't remember anything, the idea that some of these moments are pulled from her memory of watching these sitcoms when she was a girl, the idea that her memory of this person she loved is so strong that she, you know, literally recreates them. Like, it's just, I don't know. To me, there is something so fundamentally strong about the writing and the creation of these episodes in this world, that when you start to think about these larger pieces like that, like grief and memory and loss and love, the way that it ties into the whole picture, the way that you've got that macro level understanding from, you know, from everyone involved in the creative process, it's just a beautiful example of art and entertainment. And I think that the way that we digest television these days mostly has changed so much that maybe part of the issue for some people is having to wait that week. You know, is you get that first episode and then you have to wait a week for episode two. And then you get to episode two and you're like, this still isn't what I thought it was going to be. And now you have to wait another week, as opposed to being able to binge. Because I would imagine if all 10 episodes or 9 episodes had dropped at once, and you would have been able to watch those first 4 episodes in one sitting, I imagine there are a lot of people that stopped watching that never would have stopped to begin with.
Oh, sure. And we've kind of had a different experience, because I've been watching it as it's come out. So I've had to wait weeks between right. episodes. But you just recently, like right. you just binged it all in this last week.
Right. Yeah. I was able to take in 2 episodes a night, which is different. But even if I hadn't been, I absolutely would have been hooked on it from the get-go.
Oh, sure.
I do wonder about that, you know?
I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk online how this show benefits from that, because it's basically set up like a comic book. Like you have to wait for the next installment to come out, and it gives you a week to like really right. to like the episode really sit with you, and for, you know, for all the fan theories and, you know, for the guessing, especially after Pietro shows up, like, you know,
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. What the hell was that mean? I think there are a lot of shows that benefit from being bingeable. Cause I think frankly, there are a lot of shows, they aren't that great, but you don't notice it because you can binge them. But if you sure. had to wait a week between episodes, that's how I felt about Orange is the New Black. To pull on a show yeah. from a completely different genre. But I think the show really benefits from having to wait from week to week. But yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I've really enjoyed, like, I feel all of the opening theme songs nail it. Especially the late 80s, early 90s.
Yep.
Family Ties, Full House mashup.
Growing Pains, yeah.
The oh, yeah. Whew, yeah, that just...
Yeah.
That was...
Yeah, on a very special episode, the fifth episode, yeah.
That was... And that was... and I will say, as far as, like, the world cracking for Wanda, that had one of the most genuinely creepy moments. It's a small thing, and maybe it didn't hit other people in the same way, but it really hit me in a weird way, is in the opening scene of that episode after the babies are born and Agnes comes over, and Vision kind of has that little freak out about letting her hold the babies. And Agnes just completely drops character and turns to Wanda and is like, do you want me to take that again? Right. You want me to hold the babies? Oh, to me, that is so goddamn creepy.
Yeah. Well, because the thing is by this time, you know, by this episode, we realize that Wanda has been basically editing the experience in her little world, mm-hmm. which is, you know, we see all these stutters. And the thing that was so brilliant, the choice that was made, the show also benefits, by the way, from having not only from having a singular showrunner / writer in Jack Schaefer, who she is amazing. She wrote Captain Marvel and the upcoming Black Widow movie, as well as, you know, other work. And then Matt Shakman, who is the director. And when I say he's the director, I mean, he directed the whole thing. And I think that the show benefits greatly from having one director to help tie all these elements together. But even the very first episode, one of the things that I was talking about earlier is you have these like little stutters that almost look like if you're watching, you know, a show on Netflix and, you know, your internet drops for just a heartbeat or there's a weird little, you know, glitch or something. They look like that as opposed to being like an old school, you know, film cut jump or something like that. And it works so brilliantly because I think the first time it happens, you are almost fooled into thinking that there's something wrong with my internet or there's something wrong with, you know, that this isn't supposed to be happening, which is just brilliant. And then of course it happens a couple more times and you realize like, oh no, this is in the show. And so by the time, of course, we get to that moment, when Agnes asked that question, yeah, you're just sort of like, man, Wanda has been editing these experiences mm-hmm. the entire time.
Yeah.
So much so that even like Darcy, who I love, Cat Daddy's great.
Yeah.
And like, I love the fact that when she is watching the shows that she gets so invested in the show.
Yeah. I mean, like, she's just yeah.
in it.
Yeah. She's the viewer. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And, she's a character that because of her, like, this is the first time I've seen her because I had not seen Thor. So okay. I went back and I have about 30 minutes left to watch Thor now. So I've jumped back to watch that movie now. But yeah, I really enjoy her as a character. I hope she continues to go on in the universe. Is she in the other, the Dark World?
She's in Dark World.
She's in that one too.
She's not in the third one though.
Yeah, Ragnarok was the only Thor movie I had seen all the way through before.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the thing. What I love is like this has made me go back. Like I've gone back and I rewatched Age of Ultron, which I don't think I had mm-hmm. seen since it first came out. I went back and I rewatched Civil War, and you were talking about earlier about how a lot of times that they will rush character development for the sake that they get to have like a 30-minute fight at the end of the movie. I found both with Age of Ultron and Civil War. Actually, I didn't even finish either one of those movies. I got to the big battle at the end, and I was like, all right, I'm good. Like, I don't need to see the big battle at the end. Like, I get it. It's masturbation. Sure, whatever.
The one argument I would make for Civil War is that there's a lot of character development that actually happens in the battle.
Sure,
which is why I think Civil War is rightfully usually held up as one of the best MCU movies. I think they do a lot right in that, but I get what you're saying too. I absolutely get what you're saying. And don't disagree with the notion that sometimes once you get to one of those, if you're a junkie for that sort of stuff, then here you go. But if you don't necessarily need it, it's like, oh, I got the story. I'm good. You know? Yeah, the inclusion of Darcy is smart. It works. It's great. The, you know, the reappearance of Jimmy Woo, who has a, you know, a fairly small part in Ant-Man and the Wasp, is a larger character in Marvel in the comic books, but also still kind of a smaller player. But he's great in this, obviously, for many reasons.
Did you catch his card trick at the in his very first scene?
I don't know if I did.
I had missed this. I saw one of the articles. This had me sitting for like 2 days at my desk looking at YouTube videos trying to like learn how to do the card trick. In Ant-Man and the Wasp, Paul Rudd's character, I can't think of his name right now.
Scott Lang.
Scott Lang does an up-close card trick of like pulling a playing card out of thin air. And Wu was like, how do you do that? And like later in that movie, you see Wu at his desk practicing that trick. I had missed this, and then I went back and I rewatched the episode and like read the articles. When Wu is introduced in his first scene in episode 4, he does that card trick to produce his FBI badge.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, I did miss that. You know, one of the things that I will say, and part of this is because I just watched the latest episode today, I have purposely decided to, and I tend to do this just because I like to see what I can catch on my own. I haven't read anything, so I haven't like read the Easter eggs, like because I caught a lot of them, I think, on my own. But I am looking forward to reading, you know, about the rest that I didn't get. You know, of course, the biggest character I think that is not Wanda or Vision in this show, up until this last episode, is easily Monica Rambeau. And if you've seen Captain Marvel, you've seen Monica before as a little girl. I knew eventually, you know, we'd get to see her as an adult, and I was looking forward to it. In Marvel Comics, there is a period of time when Carol Danvers is no longer Captain Marvel, and who should take over the mantle but Monica Rambeau. Now, after Carol Danvers comes back and, you know, takes the mantle of Captain Marvel, Monica has developed powers of her own, and so she ends up being a hero called Photon, which was her mother's call sign in Captain Marvel. I'm thrilled that we have this character back. I think that, they have chosen really, you know, a wonderful way to integrate her into the world at large. And I can't wait to see her, you know, grow in the MCU. Tatiana Paris is great in the role. And I think that once you get to episode 4 and you really get to follow her, you know, journey through this, it's awesome. And I love the fact that here we are, you know, what, 2 years plus? About 2 years after Endgame came out, and we are able to still see the ramifications of the blip, of the snap, of Thanos' snap, and see these people coming back in ways that are genuinely, at turns, funny, frightening, incredibly sad, you know, as in Monica's case. They're not going to let something like that be swept under the rug and like, oh, we already dealt with this, it's over. It was clearly, they know it was a earth-shaking, world-shattering event, and they're going to explore what it meant for these characters for a while to come, and I'm really, really glad to see that.
Here's a bit of trivia that I didn't know about the snap blip until this. Originally, like, among the writers of the MCU, they had planned to call the event the blip. But then fans started calling it the snap. So they adapted the snap into the movies. And in WandaVision, they call it the blip. But I think elsewhere, they've kind of split the difference, and they call everybody disappearing the snap and everybody coming back the blip.
Okay.
Which I had never heard of the blip until watching WandaVision. But all that being said, yes, I love how they explore that. I love the opening of episode 4. Online, someone did a wonderful. They put like side by side or on top of bottom. They synced up Monica coming back with Hulk snapping his fingers, in Endgame, and showing all those folks, you know, showing, you know, those two things mashed up together.
That's awesome.
So that was, that was really super interesting. And, to kind of go off on a bit of a tangent, on a podcast that is nothing but tangents. After Endgame, I was skeptical of how the Marvel Universe was going to move forward, because I was like, how do you move forward after an event like the snap and have everybody come back? And how do you not have just every single movie be about that and only that and that,
right,
and that trauma? Because how can you go to anything resembling normal right now after that? And then we had COVID-19. And, and, you know, this past week, as of, you know, when we were recording this, we passed the very grim milestone of having 500,000 Americans die. I'm like, oh, that's how you do it. To keep your sanity, yeah, you got to compartmentalize.
Right. Well, and I think, and I'm an idiot. I don't know why I was saying Paul earlier. I'm sure we're going to get some comments about this from people who listen early on and then rush to their keyboards. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. It's Kevin Feige, not Paul Feige. I don't know what the hell I was thinking. But anyways, one of the things, you know, that Kevin Feige even mentioned, I think, after Infinity War, even before Endgame came out, is that we would see this have an impact, you know, throughout the films, and maybe in some unexpected ways. And the Russo brothers said the same thing. And I think one of the things that the Russo brothers did so beautifully in Endgame was include that scene of Steve Rogers leading the survivors group. They're all sitting around in a circle and they're talking, and it's just sort of like little moments like that. And then obviously seeing, you know, Black Widow's reaction to everything and you know, their trauma in particular, is a reminder that, yes, we do. We compartmentalize. We find ways to carry on, to help ourselves, to help other people. And yet, a lot of times, that trauma will manifest itself in unexpected ways. You know, I think now we've had two pieces of the MCU, Far From Home and WandaVision, deal a lot specifically with what happened and how people, you know, kind of pick up the pieces. And I am, again, I'm just so grateful for that, because they're not hitting the giant Star Trek reset button. You know, they're not just soldiering forth. They're not, you know, they are just saying these things mattered. And it will continue to matter. And I think that kind of like what you're saying with COVID is, it's like we find ways to deal. And yet at the same time, the trauma that we have experienced collectively over this past year will continue to manifest itself for years to come in some truly unexpected ways, I think. And there's so much bottled up. I know there are a lot of people, and I might end up being one of them, that the moment that we truly can go out and kind of start to get back to normal, the moment that we can really just kind of hug someone that we would normally hug, but maybe not every time, the first time that that sort of stuff can start to happen again is going to feel like such an exhalation that I don't think most of us can even comprehend, you know, the healing quality that that will have. You know, the first time Wrigley Field is at capacity for a baseball game, there are going to be people in tears as that first, you know, pitch is thrown. And that the seventh inning stretch is going to happen, and people are going to be shaking hands and hugging one another like you're at church on a Sunday and it's time for fellowship. Like, I think that there are a lot of people that have fooled themselves into things being okay and are trying to go out and do the things they would normally do. There are enough of us that aren't, that even those people that have fooled themselves aren't going to be able to comprehend the impact that those types of moments will have on them once we're able to actually return to that. And that may still be a year away.
I think that's true. I'm reflecting on, we're going on a real tangent now. Maybe we'll cut this out. We probably won't. You know us. So we decided to take, or I took Harrison today to an indoor like playground park, like Fit City Kids. I don't know if you've driven by it. It's the old Women's Workout World on Lawrence by the post office.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
And so we took them, and I felt good about it because everything that their information online is, I thought that they were doing it as safe as possible. So in the first half hour that we were there, I felt every, like what you said, like, oh, this is, it's kind of, it's almost kind of like, it feels normal. And there was like feeling like, oh, like this feels good. This is going to be good for both him and for me and whatever, back to normal. Then as the morning went on, more and more kids came in, and it was like, oh, we were under the impression, like, because I had to make a reservation for this. Like, oh, I thought, like, there's going to be, like, 10 kids here in the entire facility max. And that's not the case.
Yeah.
Okay, we're leaving.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like the, like, almost like, this is almost something like approaching normal now. Oh, no, this isn't. And it was almost like this weird kind of, not traumatic, I will say, but it's like, oh, no, we can't really get back to normal, and people are going to abuse stuff. All right, let's go home.
It's like that feeling of, like, continually being disappointed by something.
Sure, yeah.
After a while, the disappointment doesn't register quite the way that it did at first.
Yeah.
But it's still disappointing.
But it's still there, yeah. So it's like, oh, all right, maybe this wasn't a good idea after all. All right, let's go home.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, and I think one of the, you know, going back to WandaVision, actually, one of the things that's kind of remarkable in the way that, that the blip is handled is that there's this, you know, there's this sense of a rush to get back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Monica even, you know, rushes back to work with S.W.O.R.D. She, you know, she wants to be back, you know, in space, which is interesting because this is something that kind of low key gets dropped, but this is really the first that we're hearing of, like, the non superhero types going into space to try and kind of like figure out what's going on up there. Which is really cool because it sets the stage for a lot of neat stuff. And I think that, you know, in particular with the anticipation of a potential secret invasion, with the Skrulls and everything, that, that this is kind of helping to kind of set that, lay that foundation, which I think is great because if we are kind of going to be dismissing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., then any of their kind of outer space stuff that they've done, you know, doesn't really necessarily count. And I think that this is a great way to sort of lay some of that groundwork to, you know, for the future, and obviously have a character like Monica Rambeau be, you know, central to that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, she's rushing, you know, trying to get back to normal, which is what precipitates her taking this case on, you know, this missing person thing in Westview, New Jersey. I love the way that the creators really, and if I had any criticisms of the show, it would actually be geared towards the latest episode, but I love the way that for these, you know, for the first 8 episodes or 7 episodes or so of the show, they just present things as they are, you know, and you kind of have a choice as the viewer to accept them or not. You know, it's like, it's up to you to ask the questions. It's like, they want the viewer to do some of the work. They don't want to just hold your hand through everything. And so there's this lovely moment when, like, the cops are like, there is no Westview, New Jersey. And they're standing right in front of the Westview, New Jersey sign. Mm-hmm. And then they just get in their car and they drive off.
Sure.
And I feel like there are a lot of other shows that would have made a meal out of that.
Oh, yeah.
And instead, it's just like, nope, this is just the way things are. Now they're hiking, you know, taking a hike.
Yeah.
And it's great because it gives you this unexplained mystery to be engaged with, to be a part of. And in many ways, you know, you mentioned Darcy earlier kind of being our stand-in when she's watching the show. And in some ways, Monica is as much our stand-in as anything, because she's the one that's kind of like asking the questions and trying to push things forward. And I feel like by the time we get to this episode, that's a lot of us as viewers. Mm-hmm. You know, we're sitting there going like, what is happening? How is this happening? When are we going to find out more? And it is a great episode. Mm-hmm. And I love it because of the way that, yeah, those moments are tied into the prior episodes, with Monica going in for the first time, with them seeing her inside. You know, it's just... It's a real highlight, and not just of the series, but of the MCU in general.
I think so, yeah. I would definitely agree. I put this before on social media. This is probably the thing I've been most excited about out of the MCU, probably since the Avengers. Like, mm-hmm. the first Avengers movie. Say that because I feel like the Avengers movie just kind of, like, turned everything on its head of, like what, like... a big, huge tent event superhero movie could be. I feel like the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man did that in like 2001, I think, 2001, mm-hmm. 2002, did it then, and then the Avengers did it. And I feel like there have been great MCU movies since then, but like I feel like this kind of like turns the convention on its head of like what they can do.
Right, with of what it can be.
With the genre, yeah. And if I had any complaints about WandaVision, it would probably be this most recent episode because I felt like, here are my two issues. One, it was a little spoon-feedy.
Yep, exactly.
And I was like, you know, because I had read like some talk, like some speculation, like people explaining like why does it make sense for Wanda, who is not an American, to have American sitcom so ingrained in her.
Sure.
And basically like an article, like kind of like made the argument of no, because it probably something like this. And it was very much something that came out of this, what was produced out of this episode. And I was like, on one hand, I appreciated it. On the other hand, I felt like it was a little spoon feedy. And here's where I'm curious. And maybe they're going to answer this question in the next episode is, now we know, and this is my interpretation of it, tell me if you think I'm off, is that, like no, Vision is dead. Vision is dead. She didn't revive him. Like, even he is a manifestation of her imagination, of her grief. So I feel that kind of undercuts the discovery. Like the two episodes previous of Vision going off on his own and finding things out on his own.
So so first things first, I agree that it was a little conventional and spoon feedy, in a show that had been anything but up until this point. Mm-hmm. I didn't mind it overall because I felt like so much of it was well done, and I felt like Elizabeth Olsen's performance specifically really anchored. You know, she was great. I mean, let's not forget Catherine Hahn, who I didn't want to mention up to this point because I didn't want to, you know, when we were kind of avoiding spoilers, I felt like by singling her out too much might lead into spoilers. She's been magnificent. She's always magnificent. She's great in everything I've ever seen her in. But what a wonderful, like, it's just a wonderful stage for her, because there are times in the early episodes when she is obviously very committed to, this is the Dick Van Dyke Show and I'm the neighbor and this is, you know, and then there are moments when, like you were mentioning, when she's like, do you want me to take that again? Where all of a sudden she rides that line between I am 1980s, you know, nosy neighbor and I am an actor in a play asking for my line. And like, it is so seamless. It's like that, you know, they used to say, people used to talk about how great of an actor Mickey Rooney was when he was a kid, because they talked about he could be sitting in a chair offset, you know, smoking a cigarette, eating a sandwich, talking with the production assistant, all this sort of stuff. Then all of a sudden they'd say, we're ready for you. He'd jump onto the set. They'd say lights, camera, action. And he would immediately, like, he was there. There was no, you know, he didn't need any time to warm up. He didn't, you know, and that is, it's just like, it kind of reminds me of that quality of just being able to like, bam, bam. Like I don't need anything else. I'm there. I'm in it. I can play what's given. And it's just wonderful work. And then, so of course, by the time she gets to be Agatha Harkness, it's like, I think some maybe some people who are being a little bit harsher with the criticism, not that part of it's not justified, might be missing the point a little bit. Because in a show that has played with conventions, by steering into some conventions, what else could you possibly expect, and what would be unexpected in a way, than to steer into a comic book movie convention of having your villain, you know, kind of walk you through the tale of how this here, you know, when they're figuring everything out. So in a way, it's like, yes, it's exactly what you said it was. It's exactly what I'm saying it is when I criticize it as being a little spoon feeding. But yet at the same time, it kind of makes sense and it kind of works. The thing about Vision is I felt and still feel, based off of what Agatha says to Wanda, that Wanda literally recreated Vision. That is not a part of her, that is not like a part of her, you know, imagination world, really. That what she created is literally Vision. And so he has independent thought in the same way the kids do. The kids exist independently. So I think that she literally, she created them out of nothing, which is one of the things that Agatha is like, that's, you know, the most powerful power there is. You shouldn't have that. How did you become this way? You know, that kind of drives Agatha into asking those big questions. And so for me, Vision in the Halloween episode, which is also brilliant, you know, everything he does in the context of that episode is, I mean, it is an autonomous individual and not just a part of Wanda's grand plan, because I think that that's the idea. Is it's like, she, why would she create Vision to be another character in her play, like these other people have become? She wouldn't want that. She wants the real Vision. So I think that it is Vision.
Okay.
It's just a Vision who can't exist outside of this world that she's created, which I think is probably the same thing with the kids. They're real. They just probably can't exist outside the world that she's created right now, anyway.
That makes sense. That works for me.
And I think it's also kind of indicated by the fact that when she is creating Vision in the episode,
especially, yeah, the way it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's literally out of nothing. Whereas everything else is, she's drawing on things. Even when she creates the house, it's clearly drawing pieces of stuff from around her. Mm. But when she creates Vision, it's literally coming from her.
Yeah.
It's that, like, that golden energy that comes out of her, which plays back to the fact that the Mind Stone may have enhanced her powers when she interacted with it when Hydra was holding her. One thing I also loved about the episode is I love the fact that it showed us that she had powers before Hydra experimented on her. Yeah. That was one thing that I never really liked about Age of Ultron, saying that, you know, her powers were a result of experiments from Hydra. I just thought that that was a cheap way for them to get around not having mutants in the MCU since they didn't own the rights to them.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that now they're showing that she had these powers independent of that.
Yeah, sure. Now, what do we think of what's going to happen with White Vision?
First of all, I love that they did that. It's a great callback to the comics. There's a storyline called Vision Quest in particular where he is white for a while, and then he becomes, you know, the green and red and yellow Vision again, and I think he goes back to being white at one point. I have a feeling that that's going to be the way that they resurrect Vision in the MCU, that basically they are able to... Wanda ends up kind of merging her version of Vision with that Vision, and that's how we get Vision back in the normal MCU. It's weird because as I was talking with Jessica earlier, there's a part of me that wonders if that undercuts the sense of grief and loss that pervades the show if they bring him back. And the reason why I'm okay with it is because, as Agatha pointed out, this is a woman who is grieving the loss of her parents and her brother, who she never properly grieved for, and now her lover. And that broke her. Maybe one of the things that we can get out of this is sort of a sense of wish fulfillment and the idea that Vision was never really gone, you know, that because of her interaction with the Mind Stone, that maybe she always had the ability to bring him back. She just didn't know it until the end of the series. I'll be maybe a little torn, but mostly I think I'll be okay with it if that is what happens.
OK. got it. Now I'm going to throw this out there because I've seen this pop up in a couple places, and it could be this could be something that's true, and they've quickly scrubbed the internet to spoil the surprise for little people, or it could be people trolling. At a couple different points, James Spader has popped up on the cast list for this show.
Oh, interesting.
So it's speculated that when White Vision speaks in the next episode, it will be the voice of Ultron.
I would be okay with that as well. And here's the thing. If they were going to choose characters to resurrect, why not choose characters that were basically artificial to begin with? As opposed to, I hope they never, and I don't think they ever will, resurrect Tony Stark. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, God.
I'm not saying that if Robert Downey Jr. doesn't want to, like, come back and do, like, a guest spot, that they can't do some sort of, you know, thing with him. Fine. Great. Of course. I'd love to see him again. As long as we're not Tony Stark is alive again. Like, I get in comic books, characters get resurrected all the time, yes. But that's something that they've eschewed thus far. And if they, again, if they decided to resurrect something, I could see them resurrecting, like, Vision and Ultron. I'd be okay with that. Yeah, I don't know. That would be interesting. That'd be very, very interesting.
I've also seen it thrown out there and teased. A lot of people think and are really hopeful that John Krasinski is going to show up as Reed Richards. They really thought that was going to happen a couple of episodes ago when Monica was going to meet her aerospace guy.
Yeah.
And apparently, I didn't know this until recently, John Krasinski really wants to be in the MCU.
I mean, here's the thing. If he wants it and they're going to cast the role this early, he's going to get it. There's no one else that they're going to cast. The fans want it. He wants it. I'm sure they want it. Like, it's one of those things where it's just like, just do it. You know, here's the thing. I know that that movie, that the Fantastic Four movie was announced on the Disney slate this past December. And I think it's for late 2022. So I suppose if they're going to pull the trigger and they are able to do it this early, why not, right? I don't know.
Sure. I would love to see it. Apparently Matthew McConaughey really wants to be in the MCU.
I mean, I'm game.
I'm on board with that.
Yeah, I'm not a McConaughey hater.
You know, actually, I read his most recent book. His first book, his only book, basically his memoir, Green Lights. I read that recently. Good read. I'd recommend it.
I have to check it out.
Yeah. Those are my thoughts on WandaVision. I'm excited to see it next week. It's one of those. It's been a long time since I've been so invested in a TV show that I had to watch it when it first. Like within hours of it first coming out, but also I follow the accounts I tend to follow on Twitter. I need to watch it very early because it's very hard to avoid spoilers. Otherwise, and apparently, I am in good company with that because I don't know if you saw this. A couple of weeks ago, so many people logged on right after midnight. They logged on to Disney right after midnight to watch the new episode that they crashed the app.
That's awesome. Did you watch The Mandalorian?
I have not.
Okay.
I watched the first episode and just not my thing. Life is short.
Sure.
Yeah.
I've watched it. I've loved it. I thought that, you know, the season 2 finale was just such a wonderful, like, embrace of the fandom in so many ways, and set things up, you know, for what's next in some really nice ways as well. And I think that you can safely say after the success of The Mandalorian, after the success of WandaVision, and the upcoming Falcon and Winter Soldier, which I'm sure will also be wonderful. That you know, we are in for quite the treat with all of the original content that we're going to be getting on a streaming service like Disney Plus. The fact that that the streaming services like CBS All Access, which will soon become Paramount Plus, are understanding of the fact that there, you know, you have to kind of create that original content. It's only going to be great for viewers like us. And of course, in a way, they and we all owe a debt to Netflix that kind of started it all. Which leads me to the next thing that I wanted to talk about real quick. Because I know you've not seen it, and we were talking about what we wanted to talk about this episode, and I thought I'd throw this in there real quick because we wanted to talk about shows we were watching. I finished Queen's Gambit this past week. I think it's brilliant and beautiful, an exceptional piece of television about addiction and, you know, one of the most wonderful depictions of addiction that I've ever seen. Nearly any time a television show or a film deals with addiction, we're often given, you know, the melodramatic rock bottom moment and how they get out of that. We don't get to see the people who are, you know, functional alcoholics or drug addicts. We don't get to see the way that it insidiously poisons other aspects of their lives. We only see the moment where everything gets turned upside down and now they have to find a way out. The fact that this show so brilliantly portrays all of that other stuff, you know, besides rock bottom, is really quite beautiful. Anya Taylor-Joy is just amazing in the lead role. You know, there's some great actors that just pepper the series in other roles, and I can't recommend it enough. I truly believe it's one of the best things that I've seen. Period, from start to finish. I think it's a wonderful show. And I can't recommend it enough. I really can't. Like, it to me, I already include it in the ranks of shows like, you know, Mad Men, The Sopranos, and West Wing, which for me are three of my favorite shows ever. I would put Queen's Gambit comfortably to sit alongside them. I think it's that good.
Wow. How long are the episodes? How long do they run?
An hour.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
That's an investment I can make.
Some a little bit less, some a little bit more. You know, it depends.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And for anyone who's, you know, who's kind of sitting there thinking to themselves, do I really want to watch a show about chess? Trust me, it's about everything. But, I mean, chess is definitely there, obviously. But
sure. Yeah. Very much the same way MASH is about the Korean War. And,
right.
And Sports Night is about sports.
Exactly. And then back to superheroes real quick. I also did watch the premiere episode of Superman and Lois. As someone who has not really followed the CW-verse of DC Comics shows other than watching, like, the first couple of seasons of The Flash, I was aware of Superman and Lois having been cast within Supergirl initially and then carrying over into episodes of The Flash and Arrow as well. I watched a little bit of Crisis on Infinite Earths, the crossover that they did last year. I liked him. I liked what I saw of him in his first episode of Supergirl. I liked what they were doing overall. I think that those shows in general, though, are not necessarily for me. I thought that the first two seasons of The Flash were very well done. I thought they were really good. I thought there were some great moments, writing, acting, directing, whole nine yards. The rest of that stuff, I thought was fairly bad TV. Mm-hmm. I thought Arrow was a pretty bad show that got a lot of miles out of a great star. I thought Stephen Amell was great. I really like him. I thought the rest of the show was pretty bad. I thought Supergirl, kind of the same case. You had a really great Supergirl. The rest, not so much. Superman and Lois genuinely surprised me. I thought it was, with a couple of issues here or there, very well written, very well directed, out of this world special effects, a great heart to the story, some wonderful Easter eggs. It's not going to blow you away. It's not going to change the world. But if you're looking for, you know, if you're looking to watch something and want, you know, superheroes, and where else can you start but Superman? I think it's worth checking out at the very least. I love the fact that it deals with a grown-up, you know, adult Superman and Lois who have teenage sons. I think that that's really cool. I thought it was handled very well. Seeing Superman as a father is well done. Yeah, it's good. It's got a lot going for it, and I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes. I wonder if it'll be able to maintain, because obviously a show like The Flash unfortunately didn't.
I
wonder if
I go back and I watch an episode, I'll try to get into a season. It's just those first, especially that first season, first two seasons, but especially that first season was just so damn good.
The first season benefits from exactly what you were talking about with WandaVision, and compared to, you know, some of the DC stuff or the Star Wars stuff, they knew exactly where they were going from the very first episode to the season finale. They knew exactly where they were going every step of the way, and it showed. And by the time they got there, it was so satisfying, and it was just really well done.
Yeah.
I'm with you 100%. That first season was, I didn't know what to expect. I kind of binged it on Netflix after it had already aired. My nephew, my young nephew, it's his 15th birthday today, by the way. He loved the show, and he would tell me about it. And I was like, all right, I'll check it out. Because I love The Flash. I watched the original show back in, like, 89, you know? But, yeah, the first season was great. One thing that I forgot to mention about WandaVision that I will throw out there real quick. You were talking about special effects and the first scene of the latest episode. Another thing that was done so perfectly was the it's almost like it took me a second. I was like, did they? Didn't they? Did they? And then you see a close-up of her face later in the episode. The de-aging special effects that they used on Catherine Hahn in the first scene of the episode compared to what she looks like later in the episode. Like, Scorsese needs to work with Disney again because, like, the shit that he did in The Irishman doesn't even compare to what they were able to do in the beginning of WandaVision Episode 8. Like, it looked like she was 20 years younger.
Yeah.
And it was so subtle that it wasn't in your face. Whereas The Irishman, which I thought was good, I really liked it. The Irishman, man, sometimes it's distracting, especially because the one thing that they couldn't change is they couldn't change the fact that De Niro walks with the gait of a man in his 70s, not you know, the gait of a man in his late 30s or early 40s.
It was, and I wonder how much The Irishman was hurt by the fact that I know, and I don't know if this was Scorsese's choice or the actor's choice, but they did not wear the tracking, whatever you call it, the tracking pods that they do for those kind of things. Like, they did not use those when filming.
Yeah.
So they didn't have that benefit of helping them out with the de-aging. And I wonder if that's, yeah. And that was such a long movie. Good God.
It was a long movie. It was.
That was, yeah.
I liked it. I actually looking forward to watching it again. I bought the Criterion Blu-ray when it came out. One other thing that I'll add that backs up this notion that maybe there is a secret 10th episode of WandaVision. I just looked this up. The Falcon and Winter Soldier premiere date is March 19th. However, WandaVision wraps up on March 5th. Does Disney really want to go a week without having that new content? So it would seem to me that maybe, just maybe perhaps, they've reserved that March 12th date for something else.
I'm interested to see. I'll take two more episodes and then wrap it up.
Yeah,
don't
so
do
I.
it. Don't renew it. Don't give us a second season. We don't need it. Just wrap it up with a nice little bow. And then, because everything I've read says that this is directly going to lead into the next Doctor Strange movie.
Yes, yeah, because we know that Elizabeth Olsen, Scarlet Witch / Wanda Maximoff is in Doctor Strange and the Madness of Multiverses, whatever. So we know that to be fact already, which I think the pair of them will be great. I do wonder if he has a cameo, perhaps at the end, sort of come in and say, like, you need training, I'll help you.
Sure.
You
know? He'll be a post-credit, mid-credit scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I know another thing. It's interesting. This is definitely not going to happen, but it's funny to me that some people have speculated that Patrick Stewart will pop up as Professor X for a scene. And I'm just like, it doesn't make any sense because sure. We already know that she's going to be with Doctor Strange. You know, they haven't uttered the word mutant once. They're talking chaos energy. So it's like, I still think that the MCU is a long way off from having mutants.
Yeah.
Which Kevin Feige has said multiple times that he's not, we're not going to see Wolverine pop up anytime soon, you know? But regardless, I mean, WandaVision is I think fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to these last episode or episodes, whatever the case may be.
Yeah, same here. Well, I think that was a pretty good first post Quantum Leap episode.
We didn't talk about Quantum Leap at all.
No, I figured we'd find some way to segue it in there, but we did not. I will say, and this is a thing that I posted from our Twitter account. We engaged with a couple of people about this. You know, there's always speculation about a Quantum Leap reboot. There's even been even more because Scott Bakula said something a little bit about a possible reboot in a recent interview, and of course, like any site that wants some clickbait will blow it up.
Right.
I really do think if there ever is a new Quantum Leap series, it will very much follow the way of The Flash and how The Flash was a total reboot, but it finds ways to pay homage to the original early 1990s series. And I think it's probably what's going to happen. They'll pay some tribute. They're going to cast an actor or an actress who is much, much younger than what Scott Bakula was when he started as Sam Beckett.
Right.
And Sam Beckett will probably have an occasional guest star or recurring role. Or Scott Bakula will have an occasional guest star or recurring role. But I would be surprised if it was actually Sam Beckett and they were continuing the story. I have a feeling it's going to be a complete reboot. Maybe Sam will play Sam's father.
Look, all I'm saying is I would love it if they didn't have him at all. First of all, make it only 13 episodes a season. And if in the season one finale, Sam, Samantha, whoever, winds up at Al's place and the guy behind the bar is Scott Bakula. Like, that's the best place for him to be.
that's all we need. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I do want to say, too, I want to thank everyone for the comments. I know Larry posted some wonderful comments on Facebook. Adrian posted some wonderful comments as well. I'm going to forget some people. I do apologize. But we thank you guys for the comments and the engagement on the top 10 episode that we released last week. It was fun to hear people, you know, kind of give some of their thoughts and opopinions. And I'm glad Thou Shalt Not had some support as well, because the more I thought about it, you know, it was a hard episode for me to kind of like choose as one of my favorite episodes, my top episode, because I figured it would be one that people would be like, what is he talking about? But to know that other people out there love that episode and think of it as a high quality example of Quantum Leap was good to hear.
Yeah, that was great to hear. And I'm kind of shocked Portrait of a Victorian didn't pop up on either one of our top tens. No?
No.
No.
But Jessica got me good last week at dinner. I told you about this, but I didn't mention it on the podcast. Mm-hmm. We had recorded, right? And mm-hmm. I mentioned, you know, this is what we're doing. And Jessica is kind of like looking off to the side. She kind of has like just the hint of a smile. And then she turns back and she goes, you know, I think I probably would have picked The Wedding of Miyoko. And she obviously butchered the title, you know, Meeting Americanization of Machiko. And I was just like, flames shot out. It was a moment of just sheer and utter horror and delight and comedy in the Congerfein household. I lost it. I did. I couldn't tell if I was going to cry or rage or foam at the mouth. It was a lovely moment.
That's shared sweet.
Between husband and wife.
That's sweet. That's love. Yeah. So what are we going to talk about next week? I don't know.
Whew, I don't know either. Where will we go?
I don't know. I don't know. I would even try speculating here. I have some ideas. We'll put it out there on social media. If you have any ideas.
Here's a question. I'll throw a question out for listeners. if slash when, because we'll get to it at some point, not saying it's going to be next week, Dennis and I were to talk about Doctor Who. We've already kind of discussed the potential of doing kind of a, you know, not a straight rewatch or, you know, watch through like we do with Quantum Leap, but for your benefit, Dennis, watching certain episodes and talking specifically about those episodes, would listeners rather, if I were to give Dennis an assignment, I start him off with Rose, which is the first episode of, you know, New Who, as a lot of people call it, from 2005, or should I take him all the way back to the dark ages of 1963 and have him watch An Unearthly Child, which has been the default title given to the original four-episode serial. It's actually technically just the name, the title of the first episode proper, because back in the original days, the old days, each episode had an individual title, and they all made up a story title. And now, so retroactively, a lot of those stories have just been given a title based on one of the episodes. So, An Unearthly Child is the original episode from 1963.
I'm interested to hear what viewers have in mind.
Right?
What they think.
I kind of want you to do both.
Well, I've started watching the series a couple times. So I've probably watched the first episode of The Return a couple times.
Good.
Yeah. I don't know much. I don't know about the politics. I know Chris. How do you say his last name? The first Doctor Who back?
Eccleston.
I know there's some politics. There's some weirdness around Chris Eccleston and why he only lasted one season. I thought he was great in the few episodes that I saw. Yeah. I don't know what happened, but I don't know.
You know, it's so strange. For a long time, I was not aware of a lot of the stuff surrounding it. And I'm more aware now than I ever have been before. And Jessica and I recently rewatched his run, and it just started David Tennant's run. And you can kind of tell in the last episode in particular, which was not the last episode filmed, if I'm not mistaken. I think because they filmed them in blocks, and so oftentimes they're filmed out of order. But there was something about the last episode where you could just kind of get the sense that something's amiss.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, we'll get there eventually. We'll talk about it at some point.
We'll talk about that. But for now, what is the our new equivalent of Leap Out of Here? Maybe that's a convention that we keep.
Oh yeah,
Leap Out of Here.
We got to keep that one.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess for now we're going to leap out of here, and we'll see you next week with something.
Not to be confused with the Beatles song by George Harrison, mind you, but no. something
out there. All right.
Take care in the meantime,
Take
everybody.
Care. Have a good week, y'all.
I want to see